And that can be one of the more challenging parts of that process, but it's also, I think, the most rewarding.
That just seems to be where a lot of eggs are going into baskets.
And usually somewhere in there, there's a new insight.
Almost like all of this work that people almost just kind of forget.
And ensuring that everyone sort of embraced the same vision, but at the same time was empowered to make their own decisions.
I'm Colton Holmes, and today I'm your host on The Rough Draft. In this episode, I sit down with brand strategist and copywriter, Brandon Carter. Brandon's been in the industry for over 12 years, helping develop strategic narratives for VC-backed startups and publicly traded tech companies. He's an expert in helping businesses develop their brand meaning and connect with audiences across owned and earned media experiences. We spend some time defining brand and discuss the increasing importance of brand strategy for companies. We talk about how businesses are telling a story through every decision that they make and how Brandon's work helps bring order to the chaos of that decision-making throughout an entire organization. All right, here's my conversation with Brandon Carter. All right, Brandon, something you and I talked about in our pre-interview a couple of weeks ago was this idea of companies are inherently telling a story, whether they're intentionally telling the story or not, with their brand and how they approach customers and how they interact with customers. And, you know, a customer or an audience is always going to be receiving a story, whether the way that it's intended to be received or whether they're interpreting it in their own way. And so for better or worse. And so I want to talk about and ask you just to define what, you know, the term brand actually is when it's in relation to a company and what they're producing.
Sure. Yeah, sure. You can get different definitions from different people, I'm sure. But the way I think about brand is it's kind of the sum total, the sum impression that people have of a company. And they're going to form that impression in lots of different ways and through different touch points. You know, any encounter they have with the brand in the world, whether it's it could be an ad, it could be customer service, whatever it is, you know, the sum total of all those experiences inform what this company is about, you know, in a person's mind. And so that's why I think in the brand world, you know, notions of consistency come up a lot, because I think every company wants to be delivering sort of a consistent experience, giving a consistent impression, making it very clear to people, you know, what to expect from this brand and like deliver on it time and again. But in practice, you know, obviously it can be a very difficult thing.
Yeah, I think it's easy for me, at least, and I would assume others are the same, to think of brand just as the, you know, the visuals that a company produces, whether that's, you know, graphic design or video or website design, but it goes beyond that. I mean, the ethos of their story, you know, infiltrates what's my experience. And if they have a storefront, what's my experience when I walk in to when I walk out?
Yeah.
How far does that reach? And what are some things that maybe I'm not aware of that, you know, you think of as a brand strategist that I'm just never even thinking about, you know, this is also a part of brand that I'm experiencing.
Sure. Yeah. I think any touch point or interaction or communication, even if it comes through a third party, is part of sort of the brand story, you know? So earned media is a great example. Someone is writing about a brand, you know, in a magazine or something like that. That's not like the brand only has so much control in that environment, right? It's sort of in someone else's hands to sort of tell the story. But whatever a reader or viewer picks up from that story about the brand, that now is going to inform how that person thinks about that brand. Boeing is a great example. And sort of what they're going through right now, right?
Yeah.
I think very often there can be a bit of a disconnect between what a brand says and then how the brand behaves. And I can guarantee you that somewhere in Boeing HQ, the word safety is written on a wall somewhere as like a brand value. And you know, I'm sure it's been practiced, you know, for a long time. But the way things are playing out in the media right now, people maybe feel a certain type of way about that now. So that's just an example of something that, you know, even when the story is picked up and placed in the hands of other people to tell the story, that too is sort of part of, that becomes part of this overall brand impression that someone is getting.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, I think whenever you put it that way, brand just takes on this whole new weight. Rather than just, you know, the quick surface level idea of what a brand is, because every decision a company makes between who they affiliate with, who they hire, even like some small decisions might have an impact on how consumers are engaging with this brand or their thoughts around this brand. And so it just adds like a lot more weight than, you know, what I traditionally think of as a, whenever I hear the term brand.
Well, and what's kind of, I mean, you're not wrong to place some weight and value on things like logos and things like that, because I mean, those things are very, they're very useful as sort of brand shortcuts, you know, Gap blue. That's like, that's like their blue, you know, that's like, it's useful. It helps people just sort of very easily identify and form kind of a connection to that brand, you know, but it's not the only thing that defines the brand.
Yeah, the gamut and the is really large of what, you know, lives under this umbrella of the term brand and what they're what a company is building in their engagement with customers. And so, man, let's talk about what your role is as a brand strategist. Tell me about what that is and what you do.
Yeah, the way I like to describe it is I help companies decide how to show up in the world, you know, and there are a lot of decisions they need to make about that. And I think my job is to help make those decisions easier and help them help ensure that they truly are rooted in addressing the problem, you know, because every company has grand ambitions about, you know, how they want to be perceived, the growth of their business, all of those things. But they have very real challenges that sometimes get in the way of that. And that's how I view strategy. Strategy is about trying to apply whatever advantages you have on your side to a problem. So, you know, I think very often the trick there is helping brands gain clarity and sort of simplify things. Because again, it gets very complicated in sort of the day-to-day, the competitive environment, you know, is intense. It gets more intense by the day. Consumer opinions and behaviors change. They're dealing with a lot. And I view my job as coming in and sort of in some respects, maybe helping a company get back to some basics. Maybe there are things in the brand's DNA that sort of we've lost sight of a little bit, but they're there. And like, how can we then sort of apply that to, how the brand shows up maybe in a refreshing way or in a way that maybe surprises consumers a little bit or just kind of cuts through the noise and stands out from the competition.
So just kind of going back to that idea of, you know, companies telling a story and then audiences and consumers receiving that story and potentially sometimes there being a disconnect. Would it be fair to say that sometimes your role is to come in and bridge that gap and to work from both ends, from the company's perspective and, you know, really stepping into what consumers are thinking or wanting or feeling and being the bridge that connects those two?
Yeah, I think that can be, I mean, that can be one of the more challenging parts of that process, but it's also, I think, the most rewarding. I think a couple of things. I think most companies and brands have a pretty good understanding of, you know, who their consumer is. You know, they put a lot of like effort and investment in understanding that. So I always walk in kind of with that assumption that, like, you know, to some degree, like, the, you know, this company knows the audience better than I do.
Right.
But sometimes it's very easy. It's remarkably easy to lose sight of that a little bit when you're just so consumed with like the story you want to tell and the things you want to say, because you're like, it's just important.
Yeah.
We need people to like believe this about our brand, probably for commercial reasons or the competitive environment or whatever it is. And so I like to look at that process as sort of maybe a realignment with the audience and like what the audience finds important and prioritizes and how they behave, and also like what the audience expects from that particular company or that maybe category that the company is in. And so even in a situation where the company has a very good handle on the audience and, you know, stays close to the audience, I find there's always opportunity to still get more data, more insight on the consumer. There's no substitute for like talking to people, just straight up, you know, literally asking people these questions about their experience and their habits and things like that. And usually somewhere in there, there's a new insight maybe that the company maybe just lost track of a little bit that can really spark something. And like you said, maybe help alert the brand to the fact that like there is a little bit of a disconnect here. Like, I know you know your audience very well, but on this particular thing, we're missing a little bit. Maybe you didn't realize that this was a problem, or maybe you didn't realize this was a strength that like, that sometimes it's a good surprise of like, actually people really like this thing about your product, not this other characteristic that you're really trying to push.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's a super important step in the process for sure.
Yeah. And I think it's not changing, you know, the story. It's more of just telling it in a different way, maybe sometimes, because I think it's important. Like you said, like companies, they're wanting to tell this story. This company was built out of this passion for this thing, you know, most of the time. And you don't want to maybe sometimes steer away from that aspect of where this brand was originated, but more of, hey, let's try and tell it in this different way so that what you're wanting to share is received the way that you're wanting it to be received.
Yeah. I think this is part of the whole notion of being audience centric, which, you know, in some ways is like a fairly recent revelation for a lot of industries and companies. It's simply about just staying attuned to, solving, making sure you're thinking of and solving people's problems, as opposed to being so myopically focused on just like what you want to say. And again, it's very easy to lose sight of that in the day to day.
Talking about just how consumers engage with brands today, a lot of that is content driven and creator content driven. That just seems to be where a lot of eggs are going into baskets is the is the content creator. And so on that note, you came to Austin to South By to talk about, can brands act like creators rather than just always tapping into the creators? Can they develop their own platform? Can you tell me a little bit about that question and why it's so relevant today for brands and companies to consider?
Yeah. So I was moderating that panel. I was with Alicia Morales from Skillshare, Ryan Mack from Made In Network, which is a studio that does a lot of great work with creators, and Carla Lolly Music, who's a food media creator, I guess is how she would put it. But I guess sort of the question behind that question was, can audiences build, or rather, can brands amass audiences online and sustain that?
Yeah.
Because I think that, I mean, that to me is a question that's probably never going to go away. And the models for how you do that, I think we've definitely seen some shifts in the last 10, 12 years. Like, for example, 12 years ago, the answer to that question was sort of like, brands should act like publishers. That's what brands were told. Brands were told, if you want to like engage people online in particular and kind of stay engaged with them, stay close to them, you need to build these kind of editorial properties. You need to build these destination websites and like try like hell to get audiences there. Literally kind of deploy these audience development strategies of pulling in new audiences and then keeping them engaged. And I think now in 2024, it's very rare. A lot's changed, right? Like it's pretty rare to find that model. Redbull.com used to be held up as like the perfect example of this, where it was sort of this like extreme sports like media property. Mm-hmm. You know, now it's like stuff, it's like Formula One, who won the Formula One race, you know? Yeah. Makeup.com was that was like a novel thing that L'Oreal started, and it was like, what a great idea to have a site that's almost like pure wow, you know, like with all these like great like skincare tips and things like that. Now when you look at that property, a lot of that content is just curated from creators. So clearly there was a shift. Yeah. I think obviously publishers have gone through a lot in that time, have I think suffered a bit at the hands of tech and the big social platforms and all of those things. So yeah, the question was sort of like, well, what's next for brands? If that model has sort of gone away, what degree of control can brands have over developing audiences who show up for them?
Yeah.
You know, because I think what you're seeing now, you alluded to this already in this kind of creator-centric model, brands are just trying to partner and collaborate with creators, which is smart. I mean, I think that, sure, like creators have amassed so much influence and audience now, like they're rivaling the biggest media companies in the world for audiences online who like love these creators and come back to them for more and more content. So brands are always going to kind of follow the audience. Smart to partner with creators. But I also think brands usually want a little more control than that, you know? So that's where the question sort of comes from. Is there an opportunity for brands to actually act like creators and maybe adopt some things that creators do very well to develop their own relationship to audiences and develop this sort of gravitational pull online so that they know audiences are showing up for them, the brand, not necessarily showing up for the creator. And then the brand is sort of hanging out at the periphery, like, you know, like, hey, yeah, over here, look at me. You know what I mean? So that was sort of where that question came from.
Yeah. Do you think there is a brand that's doing that particularly well?
Yeah, it's funny. This came up on the panel. It's a well-known example. I think Duolingo does that very well, right? Yeah. On TikTok, like, you know, they got 10 million followers on TikTok and the content is like pretty simple stuff. It's like someone twerking in an owl costume and there are funny captions and like, you know, people just like it.
Yeah.
You know, but I think there's this perception that, you know, they're sort of the exception. It's like how often, you know, their brands should not expect to, first of all, maybe make that level of investment in like one platform, like TikTok, which, you know, we can sort of see maybe the folly of, you know, putting your eggs in one basket. Now that TikTok is under sort of legislative threat, there, you know, these platforms can always change, whether it's the algorithm changing or something regulatory happening that can really screw things up. But I think, yeah, there was this notion that came up on the panel that I think is very useful for brands to think about, which is if you're not sort of in the TikTok model, how can you serialize your expertise? I think that probably, I think most brands can use that in some way. And that doesn't necessarily mean that you have to do video at scale, which is what, you know, TikTok does, but it's, you know, it's easy. It's like kind of cheap video, but it works really well for that platform. And they've sort of started a phenomenon there.
Yeah.
But yeah, brands typically, I think, don't maybe do video at scale typically well, you know. It's like it was never really like a proficiency. Yeah. So it's something that they have to learn. But there are other ways to be, there are other ways to act like a creator. It doesn't just have to be a video thing. Newsletters are a good example. You know, newsletters are as popular as they've ever been. And you know, there's no reason a brand can't develop a great newsletter that people talk about, share with friends, ask people like, oh, do you read that? It's actually really good. That's something I, you know, advise clients on all the time. Have you thought about starting a newsletter? So yeah, there's lots of answers to that question. There are different ways of thinking about it, but I'm interested to see where it goes. I think we're just at the beginning of sort of that realization, maybe, that yeah. brands can actually learn some things and apply some things to their own marketing practice when it comes to communication and speed of production and efficiency of production, and authenticity obviously is a big one. Yeah.
I want to take a second and, you know, step into just some of the processes and tools that you use and employ when you are hired into positioning a brand. And there's a story that you mentioned a couple of weeks ago when we were talking with Francis Ford Coppola, and about the way that he approached his crew on set with The Godfather, and employed a tactic with his crew in order to alleviate some things from his perspective. Can you tell me that story?
Yeah, I'll start with the story and then I'll kind of back into how it sometimes applies to this kind of brand work.
Yeah.
But yeah, the story, I think it's probably kind of a famous story in some circles. A buddy of mine, I think, told me about it. But evidently on The Godfather, Francis Ford Coppola, I think, developed a reputation in the 70s for making these really difficult movies. Like the movies were just like at his peak. They were very difficult to make. He really suffered like physically and mentally, I think, in the process of making these movies. And The Godfather was not an exception. He was dealing with a lot of decision fatigue and just sort of realizing how much of, you know, being a director was truly just like answering 200 questions a day coming from different department heads, you know, what color should this be? What tie should Michael be wearing in this scene? And so he realized that this was not sustainable. He can't sort of focus on what he needs to focus on. And also be kind of making all of these micro decisions and sort of micromanaging the process. So he developed what is essentially a strategic framework for collaborating on this movie and ensuring that everyone sort of embraced the same vision, but at the same time was empowered to make their own decisions and make the decisions in their own way. So he basically just developed a one-word theme that distilled the meaning of the movie, you know, because that's always the question is like, what are we making really? What is this movie about? So on The Godfather, that one word theme was succession. This movie is about succession. And anyone who's seen the movie, you know, can understand that. So anyone who read the script and was working on that movie can understand that. So he found that in developing this one word theme to describe the entire enterprise, which was succession, now, when someone from the costume department came to him and asked him, oh, which tie should we put on Michael Corleone in this scene? He could say, which tie says succession to you? Mm-hmm. And the costume designer can now go and make an informed choice. Now, they might make a different choice than Coppola, you know, like maybe for all I know, there are scenes in the movie where the tie Michael Corleone's wearing, Coppola is still like, I don't know if I would have chosen that, but yeah. Let's go with it. But you know, the point is just in creating that alignment with one word across the entire enterprise, his life got a lot easier and people were empowered to go and do their thing. Cause they're experts, right? They want to make sure that, you know, the director is happy, but also, it's kind of a shame to kind of squelch their creativity in service of this, you know, dictatorial ego. Yeah. So I love that story because it's truly about empowering people. It's about ensuring that everyone is rowing in the same direction And at the end of the day, it is about efficiency too. It's right. like,
yeah.
it just makes everything more efficient. So yeah, in the brand world, I'm always looking for that one word, or maybe it's three words, yeah. but like, what is that theme or meaning that we can unlock that helps us just make all of these decisions, from what the new logo should look like yeah. to the content we should develop digitally to where we show up, you know, in the real world.
I want to kind of go from there and talk about just what is your process. And I know that you mentioned you kind of take that approach of taking one word and using that as you approach projects. And can you just kind of walk me through a little bit what all that looks like?
Yeah, sure. Well, I think very often the hard part is finding that one word or three mm-hmm. words. So I think I go into any project knowing that that's what I'm looking for.
Yeah.
But they need to be these kind of evocative words that really just nail the brand or like what we're trying to do, you know?
Yeah.
And so, but that's a process, getting to those words. It involves talking to lots of people. It involves talking to lots of people at the company. Usually involves talking to people outside of the company, partners, customers, whoever they are, doing that sort of research. And then you're trying to kind of synthesize all of these inputs, and you're literally just kind of trying to spot patterns, you know, what kind of keeps coming up in all the conversations that I'm having, you know, what are those consistent themes? What's kind of consistent feedback? Maybe there's a word that keeps coming up, and that's when I get excited. It's like, now I feel like we're honing in on a truth that doesn't feel so subjective. It feels a little bit more objective. And yeah. I think that's important in trying to get that buy-in
yeah.
from whoever it is you're working with, that like, this isn't just about, you know, pretty words and sharing our thoughts. We are trying to, we're embarking on a process to find the truth. And
yeah.
we have to gather all of these inputs, but then at some point we have to make some decisions about what's important within all of those signals. And I think recurrence is a really good way to kind of figure out what is truly important here. And then once you have those recurring themes, then it becomes, yeah, a little bit easier to now make decisions on, you know, messaging or yeah, visual identity. How can we use these words, which are now maybe functioning as like creative filters, to yeah, make decisions on color, typeface, language, all of those things.
Yeah.
That's the fun part, I think.
So with all of that, are there some principles that you have that you kind of adhere to that you instill into every project that you approach, like that you always go back to? This is the principle that I want, you know, to just continue to inform the way that we're approaching this project.
Yeah. Yeah. We've talked about a couple of them already. I think one is definitely this idea of recurrence. You know, what am I consistently encountering in terms of feedback or just information about the brand and where we're trying to go? Simplicity also is another one. That's why I love the Coppola story. I mean, if you truly can distill what might seem like a complex problem or ecosystem down into one word that everyone can understand what it means, there's like nothing better than that. And I always aspire to reach that level of simplicity sort of by the end of my work in the process.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't mean I always get as close as I want, or like I said, sometimes that can be a really difficult part of the process. But I definitely judge my own work on simplicity and clarity. Like, did I bring that to this collaboration? Because it's easy to sort of complicate things and feel like, well, if it's complicated, that it's sophisticated.
Yeah.
And think in this work, I think the opposite's sort of true.
Yeah.
The simple is sophisticated, because we all know how much work it can take to arrive at this point where we're confident in something as simple as one word or three words kind of being our framework for how we're going to make decisions.
What are some tools that you, maybe some like tangible tools or software or even, you know, physical tools that you lean on while you, you know, do your work?
There's a few. I do a lot of interviews, kind of like what we're doing now in my work. Mm-hmm. So something as simple as a transcription tool, honestly, is super useful. So I can actually have a conversation, you know, with a stakeholder where I'm actually listening. Yeah. I'm not laboring to like take notes on every single word that person says. I know there's going to be a record of this. Yeah. And if I need to kind of go back and again, look for those recurring themes and patterns, I can actually do that with a transcript. So that's a big part of it. And that actually, that helps me approach an interview again with sort of, I usually have a few objectives in mind. Like there are things I'm looking for when I have those conversations, you know? And so I don't, there's not this pressure to take notes on every single thing. I'm sort of waiting to hear. So even if I'm not 100% sure what it is, I know I'm sort of looking for a few things. And once I start to hear them, that's my moment to like pounce.
Yeah.
So that's a big one. I also think, I mean, there's a lot of AI enabled tools out there. I like using something like Perplexity.ai, which is an AI enabled search engine. And I think that's a great place to start if I'm just trying to get a picture of this company. Like, what does AI think this company does based on all of the inputs it has at its disposal? And, you know, usually I can get some, I'm not going to obviously take whatever answer is spit out as gospel truth, but sometimes I'll get some strange or evocative words in that answer that kind of spark something. And I'll write that down. Like, that's an interesting word to associate with a software company or whatever it is, you know? Yeah. And then also it's great. It'll show you sort of like the sources that it's getting this information from. So I can decide if I want to, if I need to do some more digging, I can clearly see that, okay, this is where it's getting information from. Let me do a little deeper dive on this particular source. So yeah, those are a couple off of the top of my head when it comes to, especially those initial stages of just trying to wrap your head around, all right, what does this company do? What's the competitive market like? Audience insights, you know, Perplexity.ai, I think is a great place to start. Yeah, wrapping your head around some of those questions. And then, yeah, a transcription tool that just allows you to actually be present in conversations you're having with customers, with stakeholders at the company, without worrying about, you know, losing any really important information.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. Man, it's really encouraging just to hear your entire process. And it's really fun for me to get a peek into what you do. I like the idea of that you're bringing order to chaos and that you're alleviating decision fatigue within a company and that you're creating this really streamlined approach into how a company tells their story. And it just really empowers everyone from, you know, CEO level to entry level in a company to continue to tell the same story in synergy and continue to go back to this game plan, back to this brand strategy that has been intentionally and thoughtfully and really carefully established in a brand. And it's just something that I think it seems like takes so much work and dedication and thought, and then just becomes like, hopefully I think, and I would maybe you have a different opinion, but hopefully just becomes like this second nature part of the company because it's been rehearsed so many times in so many different ways that it just becomes something that almost doesn't even get thought about as much because it becomes part of the organic structure of where the company goes is what I would assume would be like the hope is that almost like all of this work that people almost just kind of forget because is just like, oh, this is just what we do.
Totally. Yeah. If it becomes really effortful, then it probably is not going to succeed. And I think that's part of it. How easy is it for an entire collaborative, creative corporate enterprise to actually adopt and deploy whatever the whatever we're saying the solution is. And if it's really hard, it's probably not going to succeed. And that probably means there's like more work that needs to be done. Yeah. And, you know, so there is usually this sort of like test phase, right? After maybe we've kind of come to the end of the process and said like, okay, this is the solution. This is how we're going to deploy all these changes to all these different brand environments. There does need to be, I think, before maybe, you know, putting all the eggs in that basket, let's like test it out. Let's see, is it like seamless and easy for people to adopt? I'll give an example. I did an internal communications strategy project not too long ago. And that was like one of the core objectives right up front was just sort of like, we know that internal communications very often falls to managers and they're super busy. And whatever solution we come up with, it has to literally take them like almost no time to like adopt it. And cause like, we can't be creating like extra work for them.
Yeah.
That's a limitation that might sound like, well, that's very limiting. If you're saying any solution we come up with has to take almost no additional time for managers to adopt.
Yeah.
And it's like, that is limiting, but that's kind of the beauty of strategy. It is now forcing us. That's where the creativity comes in.
Right.
We now have to get creative about how we're going to like empower managers to be better communicators within the organization in a way that takes them almost no additional time.
Yeah.
Like out of the course of their week.
Yeah.
So yeah, that is a big part of it. There does need to be an ease. I've used the word simplicity a lot in this conversation, but ease, which is like maybe a slightly different word, there's a slightly different connotation there, but they're related. Ease has to be a big part, I think, of this kind of work too. There's ease of information and just sort of helping people absorb, you know, what the solution is. And then there's like ease of deployment and adoption and things like that. Those are usually things I optimize for.
Yeah. Well, Brandon, thanks again for joining us today. For those who are listening, how can they connect with you online?
Yeah, you can definitely find me on all the main social media platforms. If you're on X or Instagram, it's at Branded Carter. See what I did there?
Yeah.
Branded Carter. And yeah, you can hit me up on LinkedIn, whatever it is. And yeah, I love connecting with people. So yeah, nice. Don't be shy.
Yeah, that's funny. I was actually going to say we should title this episode Brandon on Brand.
yeah, there you go.
But I'm sure you've heard that joke a million times.
Actually, I haven't, but yeah, I like it.
All right. Well, thanks again, Brandon. I really enjoyed it. And I hope to have you back on soon.
Yeah, my pleasure. Always great talking to you and appreciate it.
Well, that's it for today's episode of The Rough Draft. To learn more about our guests and to find links and resources related to the conversation, check out rev.com/podcast. That's rev.com/podcast. If you enjoyed today's conversation, be sure to rate and subscribe in order to stay up to date with the latest episodes and help other creatives find us. Thank you for listening, and we look forward to seeing you again on the next episode of The Rough Draft.